And tonight, a special program for you here on Coast to Coast AM. First of all, we're going to be chatting with Richard C. Hoagland and a special guest this hour about the shuttle. Throughout the evening, we will monitor the space shuttle Discovery and its planned re-entry. Land on the planet at about 1:46 a.m. Pacific time. It's 4:46 a.m. Eastern time. So we'll be watching that. Then next hour, Richard C. Hoagland and Tim Ventura as we talk about anti-gravity right here on Coast to Coast. So this is going to be a full-fledged program right here. So stand by. Well, of course, now Richard C. Hoagland, the founder and principal investigator of the Enterprise Mission, a public policy and research group that has been investigating the scientific possibility of intelligently designed extraterrestrial artifacts across the solar system for the past 10 years. Richard has previously served as a museum curator of astronomy and space science, a science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News, the head of special projects at New York's Hayden Planetarium, and NASA's consultant to the Goddard Space Flight Center. In addition, Richard is the author of The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, and the winner of the Engstrom Medal for Excellence in Science. And as I go through your bio, Richard, it strikes me, of course, we lost a great newsman today with Peter Jennings.
Yeah, I really send out condolences to his family. Peter was one of those few people that, I got a really cool chance to work with, and B, who was the same off the air as he was on. I was extraordinarily fortunate in working with Walter Cronkite, and he was the same off the air as he is on. And Peter was the same kind of guy. He was obviously a bit younger, and he did not really cover space. We only did some very tangential things during the time that I was at CBS, because from time to time, whether you are aware of this or not, everyone in the audience, I know George is, but the networks all collaborate.
Yes.
If you work for one network, you can wind up working for two others. And I actually was fortunate in my career to work for all three of the biggies, ABC, CBS, and NBC, and with Brokaw and Rather and Walter and Jennings from time to time, and many others we don't have time to go into. So when I heard the news tonight, I was incredibly saddened because, you know, when we lost Peter, we have lost a gentleman in every sense of the word. And I want to say one thing in Peter's defense in terms of his UFO special.
Yes.
That special was not done by the news division of ABC. That special was not done by Peter Jennings. It was done by an outside production team that the networks hire from time to time. And Peter was presented with copy, a script,
right,
a rundown, that kind of thing.
Put his voice to it.
His own perception came through several times during the program that there is a phenomenon here that needs to be investigated, that we need to know more, and we should take this seriously. And that is the legacy I hope that this audience will take away with Peter's passing tonight.
Well said, Richard. Well said. Well, quite a night for us tonight, Richard.
It's an incredible night, and I don't think that I'm ever have been as busy on Coast since the last time Art and I tried an experiment, which was a live simulcast from the deserts of Phoenix when we did an internet radio simultaneous thingy.
Oh, that was years ago.
That was 1996. And so tonight you and I, my friend, are pioneering something different because I will have one eye on NASA. I'll have one ear on mission control. I've got the computer set to talk to your control room. I'm waiting for a phone call from one of our inside NASA sources checking a detail that we discussed earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm supposed to be part of this conversation tonight with you and a bunch of interesting people.
Absolutely. Now, also, thanks to NASA, we have NASA audio ready at any time. So when you begin to hear the kind of audio that you think we should put on with you, Richard, you just let us know and we'll just pop it right up there, okay?
Yeah, since people love backstage radio, we might do some of this stuff actually out in the open.
Absolutely.
So I'll just cue you when something interesting is coming up.
It's live radio.
On that note, I might say that a few minutes ago, they closed the payload bay doors. These two 65-foot-long doors that close over the top of the shuttle that hold the radiators that keep the shuttle from basically cooking in its own internal heat of batteries and electronics.
Yes.
And all that. They close those about a half hour before they do the deorbit burn. And they did some pretests. The doors are working fine. They closed them just before you came to me at the top of the hour. And so we're waiting now, probably another 5 minutes, for the call up from Houston to discovery that they are go for the deorbit burn. That should come roughly 12:20 your time.
How is the weather in Florida for this landing?
They've had astronauts up in T-38s. These are the training aircraft simulating the touch and go of the landing at the runways at the Kennedy Space Center. And I've been looking at the radar all night, and there are storms and rain showers out over the ocean in the Atlantic off the Cape. But over the Cape and over the landing site, it looks very clear. Looks like there's no ground fog, and it looks like we are go for landing in terms of weather.
Okay, now if for some reason they can't land at this 1:46 Pacific time, do they have another backup time?
They have one more orbit. 90 minutes later, they'll do it all again. And if the weather moves in and makes it problematic on the first pass, they can reset the clock to 90 minutes later, but then they'll have to have a wave off until tomorrow.
This will be the shuttle's 15th landing at night during darkness at Kennedy, I guess. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in fact, there are some commanders, I don't know whether Eileen Collins is one of them, but some commanders prefer a night landing, as I said a couple of times ago when we were talking, because at night, you know, I mean, I love flying at night. Now, I don't mean in the cockpit, although I've done that. But just looking out the window, you can see so much more. And of course, for landing in a glider, a 100-ton glider, you really don't want to miss that runway. So you want to be able to see it in the floodlights and with no bright glare off lakes or reflections off clouds or stuff. So a night landing is actually kind of preferred. Plus the weather in Florida this time of year, oh, do I know this, is much better at night or pre-dawn than during the day or the afternoon, God help
us. Sure is. There is a nervous excitement, Richard. Excitement because we all want to get this shuttle Discovery back down to planet Earth. We want to get it on the ground. The nervousness, of course, is because so many things did happen during this mission. We're a little concerned to make sure that everything's okay.
Well, we're more than a little concerned. I've got to tell you that if I didn't admit on open air tonight that I am very concerned, I would not be human. And I know there are many other people listening who are kind of biting their nails the same way, because just 2.5 years ago, we had the shock of our lives when Columbia did not make it in this particular part of the flight. And we all know why now, because of problems with the tiles and the leading edge of the wing and falling foam and all that. Fortunately, a lot of things have happened in the last 2.5 years to basically repair those problems, to prevent those problems. And we know more than any other shuttle mission going into this critical period tonight that this bird has a clean bill of health. Never before have we taken pictures, done laser scans, had an astronaut actually out under the belly looking at it through a visor from 3 inches away. So the crew feels excellent that their bird is fine. I feel pretty good that the bird is fine. And we have a gentleman with us tonight, an old friend of mine that I wanted to bring in, our mystery guest, who has lived through these things firsthand in mission control at NASA. His name is Ken Johnston. He's an old friend of mine. He was a former test astronaut, and he will describe what that means. And the unique thing tonight is we're all concerned about tiles and reentry and heat protection, is that Ken was the guy at Houston who actually physically donned a spacesuit and did a simulation long before Steve Robinson of how to apply caulk to the tiles as a way to repair tile damage in orbit before reentry.
Richard has
Are you there?
Richard has been hinting for the last week of this surprise guest, Ken Johnston. And Ken, welcome to Coast.
Well, thank you, George, and good to hear you again, Richard. And George, we actually met about, I guess about 3 years ago at the University of Phoenix, so good to talk with you.
Yes, Ken. Good to talk with you as well, Ken. Richard, with Ken's expertise, let's chat a little bit, if we can, about this tile repair issue. How serious is it at this point?
Okay, remember, I'm keeping one ear on mission control to hear if we're going to get the go for a deorbit burn here.
Understand.
It is everything. NASA has an old saying, and Ken obviously interrupt me at any point here if I make a big goof, but the old saying is no single point failure. You design spacecraft on the odds that something will go wrong, so you have a backup. And in many cases, you have a backup for a backup for a backup. The problem with the shuttle, the central problem with this 30-year-old spacecraft, is it only has one system to safely re-enter the Earth's atmosphere at 17,500 miles an hour and dissipate all that heat. And that's the TPS, the Thermal Protection System, colloquially known as the tiles. And if you lose tile, you have cracks in tile, or God help us, one falls off, you're in deep doo-doo, as George Bush once said.
Ken, the expertise that you have with these tiles and tile repairs, are you concerned at all about this?
Well, I have been quite concerned as the news came out with the information about the insulation falling off and possibly hitting the shuttle. The opportunity actually to be able to go EVA and get close-up looks at the tile kind of gave me a little bit more of a confidence in it. And having been involved in the overall design of the tile repair system some 25 years ago, I might add, and then actually seeing some of it taking place, I think one thing that might add here, Richard, and that is part of the reasons why we don't have a real backup to the thermal protection system is that as it re-enters the Earth's atmosphere, any type of deviation, let's call it a dent or missing tile or in one of these spacers that they were discussing earlier that...
the infamous gap fillers.
Right, the gap fillers could change the overall aerodynamics of the entry, and then that itself could cause some problems. So, yes, I've been very, very concerned about that, but then I'm glad to see that things are moving on quite well.
This change of the possible aerodynamics of the entry, I mean, it doesn't have to be much. It could be, what, less than a degree, and it could have a problem, Ken?
Well, let's see. I'm not that up on the space shuttle itself, but then at least 1 or 2 degrees, and then you can start having some perturbations, and you could start to get some oscillations, and then it just you can get behind the spacecraft, even though it's being computer-controlled, and then the entry could go awry from that point.
I would assume, Ken, that these shuttles that have landed over the years have come back with problems. Richard, we talked about this last week. Tiles have been gone. Things like that have occurred. Of course, we were sensitive to this now because of the disaster with the Columbia.
Super sensitive.
But it is not unusual to have these problems, though, is it?
Well, they walked around, you know, kicked the tires and looked up under at the heat shield after they've landed. All the crews have done this, and NASA's had photo ops, you know, with photographers and newsmen out there walking around the shuttle after it's safed, after the hydrazine is drained off, and it's basically just an inert glider sitting there. And you can see on those pictures things like gap fillers that have come down and stuck out. What made this different is they never had these kind of pictures of the underbelly, this incredibly important set of tiles, before reentry. So, of course, in this super cautious mode, they started doing all kinds of simulations and computer calculations, and they basically were concerned with what they call a boundary layer trip. Now, Ken, of course, as an old pilot, I didn't mean that old in that sense, Ken.
Right.
It knows what boundary layers are all about. So why don't you take it away?
Well, we started talking about it a little bit earlier, and that is anything that can interfere with the smooth flow of the air over the lifting surface, in this case, on the belly of the spacecraft.
And at Mach 25, if that flow goes from smooth, or laminar as it's technically called, to turbulent, the heat pulse into the tiles, into the airframe, into the shuttle, could be greater than the shuttle tiles could withstand. So you don't want anything sticking up causing turbulent air in that critical boundary.
And it would rip off other tiles?
It could do that. It could soften them. It could soften glue. I mean, you can get a whole cascade effect. And they did all kinds of calculations, and they said, we better take those little two gap fillers out of there so we have a smooth boundary layer again.
I believe that when they asked the question if they could be 100% sure that there was no that it wouldn't cause a problem, and since there's so many variables, no one would come up with a 100% sure, then the decision, it was a simple decision, remove them. And back a little bit there, Richard, on when they had landed in the past, the real question would be, when did those tiles come loose during the descent and approach, and when did the gap fillers possibly hang down on past flights when they've done their walk around afterwards? So it's, you know, we don't really know at what point that may have taken place.
Ken, tell us what it was like for you over 20 years ago when you donned a spacesuit to assist and try to work out some of these problems. Take us kind of through the steps.
Okay, well, it really goes back to what I originally did as a test pilot for Grumman and worked as the liaison with all the astronauts, went through all the training, and then it's my job to be in the spacecraft at all times to answer questions. We were one of the five test pilots they had. So this gave me a lot of experience in and out of spacesuits. And then when we moved on over into the shuttle program, having that past experience when I was working with Hamilton Standard and ILC with the spacesuit assembly, we had a PDR, that's a program design review, that came up and said, well, okay, is there a way that we could repair tile if we knew we had some damage? Some of our thermo engineers came up with a type of, I call it a goop, but it's a kind of a putty system that once extruded out would actually set up in hard vacuum. And then the question came by, well, how could we deliver this material in a way to fill the holes while we're on orbit, which meant there were couple of opportunities there. Either you'd use the shuttle manipulator arm, and then the other question, well, if it, you can't reach it with that arm. Fortunately, on this flight, STS-114, we were at the space station. We were able to actually use that much larger and greater reach manipulator arm. But the other possibility was to use an MMU, or the manned maneuvering unit. In this particular case, they developed a delivery device, kind of a canister that had a little bit of a neck to it with a sort of a funnel device that allow us to spooge out this stuff. By the way, the consistency of this tile repair putty was exactly the same as Skippy peanut butter. So in some of the pictures, if some of the people were to see them, I'm actually using Skippy peanut butter and spooging it out and trying to smush it into a hole.
Without the chunks, right?
Yeah, that's right.
No, the smooth kind, right?
The big key problem we had with using the manned maneuvering unit is it could only keep you station keeping, roll pitch, yaw, and translation on that line up to about 6 pounds per square inch pressure. So the real question then came, could an astronaut, first of all, manipulate the device to get this putty stuff out onto a trowel? Then can he get close enough to the areas on the shuttle with the MMU? And then thirdly, could you put enough pressure on the trowel to force this putty into the cracks or crevices or whatever the damage might be before you would overcome the reaction control systems of an MMU and start tumbling backwards? Well, that was where they brought me in to help them out, because it's amazing. Engineers, unless they've been in space or been in spacesuits, have absolutely no idea what the dexterity or the capability of an astronaut in a spacesuit fully pressurized is. So they bring in some of us. And we get, in this case, they strung me up by a chain with 600 pounds on my back to simulate the MMU's center of gravity in a high bay hangar about 2.5 stories high. And so that whenever I got up close and I smushed this stuff into the cracks, would I go tumbling backwards or move away? So it was quite an exciting thing, and probably a little bit dangerous too. But then we were young and stupid then, so we did a lot of things.
Did they learn a lot?
Absolutely. And we actually proved that we could use the MMU and move around even nose cone and then on the underside of the shuttle and be able to get close enough that we could actually do the repairs. In fact, I left NASA in Houston shortly after that in 1980, December of 1980. So I was, in my understanding is that it was the direction from the program director that a shuttle repair kit would be carried, a tile repair kit would be carried on board each flight. And then somewhere down the line at some other PDR, program design review, someone made the wonderful decision that we could save weight. We didn't take that along.
Oh, how much would that weigh, Ken?
Oh, it really wasn't much more than about 15 to 20 pounds.
Isn't that incredible?
It really is. Richard, stay with us. Ken Johnson, we'll be back. We'll continue to talk more about all of this as we monitor the shuttle Discovery and its planned reentry back to planet Earth. I'm George Norrie, along with Richard C. Hoagland, and our guest this hour, Ken Johnston, right here on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back at the top of the hour, of course, our guest will be Tim Ventura, along with Richard C. Hoagland, as we talk about anti-gravity and new propulsion systems. But first, the rest with Ken Johnston and Richard C. Hoagland about the Space Shuttle Discovery and those tiles. We just want to give you a little bit more information before the planned reentry, which will occur at 4:46 a.m. Eastern Time. And And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Thank you for listening to us tonight, by the way. I'm George Norrie with Richard C. Hoagland and Ken Johnston. Ken, of course, was involved with the tile repair issue more than 20 years ago at NASA. Richard, can you give us a shuttle discovery update? What's going on now?
Yeah, there's been a small change. The weather at the Cape appears to be changing.
Oh, really?
And they just radioed up to Eileen Collins, who's commander of the flight, that there were some showers popping up. They appeared, the forecast is that they will dissipate, but there's some other kind of front that is apparently forming, and they are looking very carefully because, remember, they have two opportunities tonight, 90 minutes apart, to do this at the Cape. So they gave them a go-ahead for what they call euphemistically fluid loading. And I was going through my stuff here. What in the world is fluid loading? And then the mission control commentator came on, and he said basically they're all being told to drink a lot of water because the more water they drink up to a certain point, the better the body withstands the rigors of the high G loading during reentry and landing.
Really? So it could be a rough one.
Well, not necessarily. It's just something they do on every flight. And Ken is... actually had some time in, some centrifuges and can tell you what high G's are like. So if you can dissipate the G's with more fluid in the body, that's better.
All right, well, why not a site at Edwards Air Force Base? Why don't they just take it the easy way? So the weather here in California is fine right now.
Actually, there are some personnel there that would be the landing site tomorrow if they have to wave off tonight completely. But they want to try to get it back to the Cape for obvious reasons. They want to inspect it at the Cape. They want to move along as smartly as possible with the next shuttle mission. And Discovery is the backup shuttle, the rescue shuttle for Atlantis, the way Atlantis was the backup shuttle for Discovery, as they pursue the tile problem, the gap filler problem, the foam falling off the tank problem. So it would also save quite a bit of money if they can land at the Cape.
Michael Griffin, though, NASA administrator, says that these shuttles are grounded until they can figure out what's wrong. But you don't think that's going to take long?
It's not me thinking, it's what they're saying, and I don't frankly know. I think it's going to be a much more serious problem fixing the foam on that tile ramp and potentially the foam that also fell off the areas where they had thought they'd fixed it. Remember, they had a big chunk come loose right under the bipod ramp, those two struts that stick up from the tank and hold the nose
Yes.
of the shuttle onto the tank. If you looked at those photographs, and we have some on Enterprise, you see a huge chunk of foam bigger than your fist came out of an area they supposedly had fixed. So I don't think this is going to be quick, but the bottom line is they would prefer to land Discovery back at the Cape tonight.
Ken Johnston, with all the meteorologists that they have on staff at NASA and the high-tech equipment, why are they just figuring this out now about these fronts that are rolling in?
Well, I'm sure they've been following the weather back then. I know they have. I've been watching it off and on all day. And it's just one of those things that you have to watch and see how the different fronts develop. For a while, when we had the chase planes up and the T-37s or T-38s, and it looked like it was going to be a go, and it could still be, just it's something you're going to have to watch very, very closely. And I'd like to add something, Richard, having to do with the loading up. Back when we were actually doing these tests, anytime you're inside of a spacesuit, you're inside of a bubble balloon, and we have these liquid-cooled garments we wear inside. And, for instance, when I was doing that test for about 5 hours, I actually lost upwards of 8 pounds of water loss. So they're going to be sitting in there in their spacesuits waiting for their deorbit burn. They better load up while they can.
I just saw a glimpse of the radar, and there's radar showers offshore. And in Florida, they can quickly move onshore. There's also another group of showers that are over on the west coast of Florida, where the panhandle connects with the body of the state of Florida.
Yes.
So they're kind of caught between two sets of showers, and depending upon how the local low-level winds are moving, they could move into the landing site. And so you can't land the shuttle in rain. This is one of these irritating things. We have a spacecraft so fragile that if it flies through a rain shower, the tiles all get completely unusable. So you would basically have to put all new tile on Discovery if it flew through a shower on the way to landing.
All right. Now, also, though, now, let's assume the landing site is clear, weather's fine, the shuttle's coming in. I would guess, what's the distance, Richard, once it starts its reentry? Are we talking about, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles, or does it kind of like drop in on where it's going to be.
You're talking thousands of miles. This thing is starting reentry over the Pacific.
So it could be coming through all kinds of weather for
us. You're up at 400,000 feet. You're still in space, essentially. You don't get down to the lower atmosphere until the final few miles. So it's basically the local weather in Florida is the big concern. You're flying all above weather all the way in till just a few minutes out.
All right, Ken, tell us what it's like for reentry with these astronauts. What are they doing? What are they dressed in? Are they wearing their helmets? Are they all just completely encased? What's going on?
Well, they actually have a pressure suit that they're wearing, and that would be to protect them in the event that they had any kind of a puncture of the pressure vessel itself. They would still be safe inside of their spacesuits.
If you lost the air in the cockpit, in other words.
Right. That's okay. What I was going to say. Thank you, Richard.
That's what I'm here for.
That's why we have him here.
Richard puts it into the words that layman can understand.
He sure does. That's why he's so successful on this program, Ken.
Absolutely. Anyway, and with regards to the entry, they're still going to be inside their spacesuits. They had them on during launch and then upon landing. And as Richard well pointed out, this space shuttle is like a gliding rock, and it's coming in extremely high, and it's going to drop straight down in, not straight down, but at a very steep angle into Florida, and then just, so the local weather is the only thing they're going to have to look out for.
How do you feel about this planned landing, Ken? I mean, do you feel comfortable here with this?
Well, if you go back and look at after we had the Apollo 1 fire, which I was there for, and then we had the still trying to maintain the schedule to get to the moon and back within the one decade. The first flight we had after that was probably the safest flight there would be. And if I was given the opportunity to choose which flight I would have gone on with the shuttle, I would have chosen this one, because you better believe we checked every single possibility.
Me too, Ken.
Say again?
This is the one I would like to be on, because everybody looked at everything.
That's right. But they missed a spacer, either that or it vibrated out during.
Well, what they do is they vibrate out, and right. We've never had the opportunity, you know, speaking from NASA's point of view, these things are not for heat, they're for chatter. When the shuttle goes into orbit on those rockets, George, particularly those two solid rocket boosters on each side, there is a hell of a vibration. And Wayne Hale was actually saying with awe, I mean, here's a guy who's been with the shuttle program since its beginning, as long as Ken was, and he's still there, unlike Ken going on to other things. He said he learned the other day when they were doing the X-band radar tracking of the ascent into orbit, he said, I didn't know you could see the shock waves go through the vehicle on radar. That means there are rippling waves. This thing is acting almost like a living organism as it goes into space because of the vibrations and the shock loads and the aerodynamics and all that motion basically makes these tiles move one against the other. So to prevent the tiles from chipping, I come back to how incredibly fragile that system is. They have these little spacers called gap fillers made of a ceramic cloth stuck in between the tiles. They don't need them for that chatter effect on the way down. It's much smoother on reentry than going into orbit. But they don't want them sticking out, and that's why Steve Robinson went out on the end of the arm and plucked the two out with his gloves. Let me ask Ken a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Ken, since they didn't have the arm mobility then, and they were looking at doing this with an MMU, which is really a backpack with jets, weren't they concerned that you would inadvertently smash up against the bottom of the shuttle simulator and make more gouges and have tiles fall off and all the awful things we thought might happen with Robinson?
Absolutely, Richard. One of the things that we did during that test, there's some 20-some-odd years ago, was to let me use the MMU. Of course, on 1G, I couldn't carry around 600 pounds. I had to have me suspended a bit to see how close I could get. Did I have to retract the MMU's control arms to get them out of the way for me to get close enough to use my arms?
Oh, those are the two little arms that stuck out in front of you like little armchair arms.
Right, and that's where my controls are to operate the MMU, your roll pitch and yaw one side and your translations on the other. Anyway, we found that we could get real close, but it was a pilot technique that would have to have been practiced. I think that when you asked earlier, George, about the weight, the problem about weight really was having to carry an MMU on board for being able to get away from further away from the space shuttle and then fly around with an MMU. So you're talking about an extra 600 pounds there, not just the weight of the tile repair kit.
You said you were there at Apollo 1 when that situation occurred. Gus Grissom, Ed White, Roger Chaffee. Tell me a little bit, Ken, about that episode in your life.
All right. Well, I was actually at the Johnson Space Center, and my family has had a unique experience in being at the right place at the right time, I guess, and maybe with the right stuff. Some of us did. My first cousin, Captain Don Garrett, was with the Air Force MOLD program, which was originally going to be an Air Force space-type program, and he was substituting for the astronauts at the Cape on Apollo 1, later became Apollo 1, had just gone through the complete switch configuration sets and had gotten it out, and Gus and Roger and Ed had crawled in. He basically helped him strap in, got out, got his T-37, was on his way flying back to Houston when he got the call and said we'd had the fire.
Oh,
I was there at Houston. At the time, we were preparing the large vacuum chambers for the up-and-coming lunar module test, and then we got the word, so we were just absolutely devastated and shocked over it. Meanwhile, my brother was there at Houston, and he was a NASA launch control engineer, so we had three family members all working on the programs at the same time.
I got to tell you, it was a dark day for America.
Yes, it was.
I remember that explicitly. But the space program continued through the tragedies, Ken and Richard, and there, I'm sure, will be more in the future as we one day plan to go to Mars, going back to the moon, of course.
Right.
These are brave men and women, aren't they?
Well, they're incredibly brave, and I keep thinking, you know, at one level in this discussion tonight, Ken, how unnecessary it is that we'd be sitting here talking about all this 30 years later. The shuttle was never planned originally, as far as I know, and I had a pretty good source on that. Werner von Braun himself was never planned to go for 30 years.
No.
And there's a reason that we're still flying this thing, and I want to, you know, speak respectfully of it because there are seven human beings who are dependent on it to get them home in a few minutes. But in fact, Ken, there were other plans that we never got to, and why not?
Well, I used to talk on the NASA's speaking bureau, and we would talk about the budget. We were so open with our space program that we would talk in terms of the millions of dollars per flight or millions of dollars or billions of dollars. And the average person, and no slight meant here, is that if it costs more than their car or the house, it's obviously a waste of money without realizing all the spinoffs that we got from the space program that's helped mankind throughout. So in reality, then when you have the populace not really behind or understanding what we're getting from it, talking to the congressional leaders who then pull the budget and prevent us from being able to go. And we really, as fast as we were moving to get to the moon and back, we should have had our colonies on the moon and already have colonies on Mars at this time. There's no question about that.
And we could have if we had kept up the pace, couldn't we?
And or there's still the question, did we?
Well, that's something we're going to be discussing when we get Tim on, because frankly, I have some evidence tonight that does support this wild urban legend we've all, you know, kicked around over the years and talked about, Ken.
Well, and,
right,
and let's hold on.
Maybe two space programs.
Ken, tell me a little bit about what you just said, because that coming from you is pretty mind-boggling.
Well, I was in numerous positions with NASA, and one of them was at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. I was in charge of all of the film when it came back to get it processed and then show it to the engineers and scientists that were involved first. And I was firsthand present during looking at some of anomalies on the lunar surface that we couldn't explain. And I've explained those to Richard before, and also there have been many things that have shown up since then. So with that and some of the conversations I had with some of the people that always left me with a question, what were they holding back? And a perfect example is when we were looking at the films from Apollo 14 on the backside of the moon.
Right.
I can't recall the name of the particular crater, but as the craft's coming over in the shadow portion of that crater, there were like five glowing lights and a column that appeared like a plume of steam or something coming straight up in a vacuum. And I was asked to stop the film and take a good look at it. And Dr. Thornton Page, who was the director of the astronomy department and astrogeology, he said to the other eight scientists there, he said, "Well, boys, what do you think of that?" And they all chuckled and laughed like it was an inside joke. And then I was told to move on. Well, the next day when I showed that film, that portion of the film had been removed and was no longer there.
Really?
So I've seen places where we've had airbrushing done on lunar pictures, lunar surface, as well as lunar orbital.
Now, some of these anomalies, Ken, would they be, and let me ask you two different theories then, the way I look at it, would they be anomalies of perhaps man-made vehicles and structures that might have been on the moon from earlier Earth civilizations? Are we talking about extraterrestrial anomalies? Because surely there wouldn't be that much excitement about moon-based anomalies that were just natural structures.
No, I think the evidence shows that some of the arcologies or some of the structures that we got the indication were that they're of ancient design, yet what we were looking at on Apollo 14 was something that was alive. Let's call it alive because it was still lights and functioning and steam, and something was going on. So you have both ancient and current stuff going on.
Now, would they come, do you believe, extraterrestrial from outside or from planet Earth?
Well, the way I answer that as a solar system ambassador for NASA is that I have seen things that were hard for me to explain as a pilot, but I have not yet spoken to or met an alien up front and close. Although, if there aren't any intelligent beings out there, it's an awful lot of wasted space.
So here you are, though, an expert in space. You worked with NASA, and you're saying right now tonight that it's possible that there could be some very strange anomalies there on the moon and maybe elsewhere.
Absolutely that, as well as on Mars, too.
Richard, you may have been right all along, Hoagland.
I think that we're going to find that's true.
Rich, what's going on with the weather?
Unfortunately, the weather's deteriorating. They just gave a call up to Eileen Collins. They informed her in guarded tones that they're proceeding to the middle of page 3 in their checklist for the deorbit burn, and they'll get to that point, and then they'll give a kind of a go-no-go. But they just had a nice shot at night from the chase aircraft, the T-38, that's doing the simulated touch-and-go landings, and they're now getting broken clouds down to 1,000 feet, 4 miles out, exactly what they don't want, because those clouds are full of little droplets, and they will cream those tiles.
Ken Johnston, Richard has expressed his reasons why they don't want to land at Edwards Base in California, but to me it seems like the easiest way.
Well, as the backup, as Richard pointed out, we always had multiple backups, and that would be what we would have to fall back on if Florida is socked in, as we call it, and they would have to deviate and make a landing there at Edwards.
Richard, this is a very strange, strange flight. I mean, it's almost like fate is doing all kinds of things to it.
Well, there are a lot of things riding on this flight, and I don't think it's an overstatement to say that getting Eileen Collins and her crew home safely, either tonight or tomorrow night, on terra firma, is essential for the continuation of NASA itself. If, God forbid, there were to be some kind of accident or something would crop up at the last minute and this crew did not make it, I think NASA would be over. And a lot of my colleagues believe that. There's been a lot of discussion over the last several days about potential, even up to and including threats against the shuttle, because that's the vulnerable part of the entire open civilian NASA program. So I would like, you know, as we go out at the end of this hour, for this Coast audience that's done it so many times, George, and maybe you want to do this more than me, but we can put a shield around this mission. We have enough brain power, enough consciousness, coupled together with how we now know it works, good old hyperdimensional physics, that if everybody in this audience listening to us right now were to focus in their mind on that shuttle and those 7 incredibly brave people, they will come home.
Better yet too, Richard, I think even to play it safer, why don't we just all say a prayer? We'll be back in a moment. Ken Johnston, thank you so much for being part of the program this hour. Next hour, Richard C. Hoagland, he'll give us an update with a shuttle discovery. And also Tim Ventura joins us as we talk about anti-gravity propulsion right here on Coast to Coast AM.